Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Assad and the Armageddon option, we hear an extract from Charlie Rose's CBS interview with the boogeyman, President Assad. Also, it sounds like something out of Dan Brown, but have secret societies been planning world wars for centuries as part of a plan to dominate the world? We take a look at the letter believed to have been sent in the mid-1800s from American Mason Albert Pike to Italian Mason Giovanni Mazzini. Picking up where we left off last week, as Germany splashes out to restore the Nuremberg Stadium, where Hitler held his famous rallies, we ask, what were the Nazis really all about? And is that a good way to spend £60 million of public money restoring the Nuremberg Stadium? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, not so hot as they were last week, thank goodness. Anyway, Martin, let's start there, and let's start with Syria. What's the latest?
Well, as I understand it, they're now talking about Syria joining the Chemical Weapons Convention, and that seems to have pushed back any military strikes by the US for now. But Assad is saying he wants the Israelis to join the convention, and he wants to guarantee that he's not going to be attacked. So, in other words, the Americans could then use that as he's not being serious and so on. The danger of war is still very much there. The war is going on. There's been fighting this week between Kurdish Peshmerga and the al-Nusra front in northern Syria. This is far more complicated than people realise. The KDP, who run the Kurdish Democratic Party, who run northern Iraq, their Peshmerga may come over the border to join in the fight against the al-Nusra front. And so it's a bit like Lebanon was in the 1980s. There's more than two sides in the battle. There's all the different factions, some of them ethnically based, some of them ideologically based, are fighting with each other as they fight the government or on the government. The government side, in fact, is relatively cohesive, but the rebels are split into at least 100 factions, I understand.
And one of the things that Amy Goodman has pointed out at Truthdig, I mean, she's also does other things on the internet, but she wrote a special article for the 9/11 anniversary this week, the September the 11th anniversary, 12th anniversary, and she's pointing out that actually on the very same day that Secretary of State John Kerry was meeting with one of his predecessors, a certain Henry Kissinger, to discuss the strategy on the forthcoming negotiations on Syria with Russian officials. So Kerry is apparently been discussing this with Russian officials, but first he goes and asks Kissinger, what should I say? Is this normal for him to go and chat to an old Secretary of State from the Nixon era to get a bit of advice?
Yeah, and somebody who's regarded by many as a war criminal. For the bombing of Cambodia, amongst other things. I mean, this just goes to show that the US establishment does not perceive how it is itself perceived in the rest of the world. There's evidence coming out. I've been following this very closely. The evidence is coming out that Western intelligence services working with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, A, started the whole war in Syria in the first place. B, the chemical weapons attack outside Damascus was probably carried out by them in order to try and get an airstrike going. Now, if we find that Western intelligence services, MI6, for example, were involved in a chemical weapons attack in Damascus, what should we do about that?
Can you just flesh that out a little bit and stand it up? Let's roll it back a bit.
Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister in the Sarkozy government, has been saying on French television for the last week or so that he was approached by British officials at an international meeting before the Arab Spring, and they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to join in with us? That's what he has said. Now, I put this, if David Cameron is listening, I put it to him. Is Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, a liar? Or were British officials talking about an armed uprising in Syria before the Arab Spring? That's point number one. Point number two, a US internal military report was leaked yesterday, which shows quite clearly that the al-Nusra front were caught by Turkish police inside Turkey with 2 kilograms of non-conventional sarin. Now, this, in other words, there is no doubt that the rebels have been using chemical weapons. There is doubt about whether Assad has been using chemical weapons. Nobody's been able to prove it. But the rebels definitely have. And the weaponry they've been using has been shipped to them indirectly from Saudi Arabia. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia seems to be the source for all of this. Now, if it turns out that our allies, the Saudis, which Filton up here, they sell a lot of things to the Saudis, if it turns out that it's our allies that carried out this chemical weapons attack inside Damascus, which killed 1,500 people, according to the Americans, 1,425, I believe, they're very suspiciously precise, is it time for the Royal Navy to get down into the Gulf and bomb Riyadh and overthrow the Syrian regime? The Saudi regime, which currently kills people with chemical weapons. Slip of the tongue there. I said Syria, I meant to say Saudi. Now, if we're going to grandstand about people not using chemical weapons, of course, the fact that the US Marines used white phosphorus in Fallujah, should the head of the US Marines be put on trial at the International Criminal Court? Or should we just bomb Washington? I think this is an extremely dangerous situation, but I think the Russians have played it very, very cool, very well. Another thing that people haven't noticed, the Russian capability in the Eastern Mediterranean is quite enough to take down NATO's squadrons. And if you think I'm joking, people need to look up what the Russians have been developing over the last 30 years, which is the capacity to take out aircraft carriers. The US has 37 aircraft carriers, Britain has two. The Russians have now developed, and the Chinese have developed, the capability to take out aircraft carriers very quickly and very rapidly.
Yes, they've got their aircraft carrier killer, haven't they? Slowly chugging right now across the Mediterranean towards the east.
That's right.
Now, this thing can take out simultaneously, apparently take out 16 aircraft carriers at the same time.
That's right. And that's why all this talk of war may come to nothing, because as the old Roman senator said, if you want peace, prepare for war. And the Russian general staff has been preparing for war for quite a long time, since 9/11, because they, frankly, they see 9/11 as an inside job. They see it as a false flag attack. And, of course, this is NATO's standard modus operandi, is false flag attack.
I noticed also on Question Time last night, Caroline Lucas mentioned the US and the UK's use of depleted uranium weapons. Now, chemical weapons, I'm not condoning them at all, but at least after several hours, the gas disperses. With depleted uranium, this substance is left in the environment for thousands and thousands of years, and poisons, brings about genetic mutations in generations into the infinite future.
Yes, and I think what people need to realise is it may very well be that our own intelligence services, the Roland Dumas revelation is the most important one, because he specifically said the British, not the Americans. So MI6, who've got a track record of trying to overthrow governments of Syria, they tried to overthrow the government of Syria in the 1950s. Not many British people know about that. Plenty of people in Syria know about it. And in actual fact, it could be that the whole bloodshed in Syria is an orchestrated plan by our own intelligence services. Now, if it turns out to be the case, then I want to see the leaders of MI6 sent to The Hague. And if they were working on political orders, I want to see the politicians who gave the orders sent to The Hague.
Well,
that's what's got to happen.
A couple more things. Syria has ratified the chemical weapons ban. I would imagine that the chemical weapons will be removed from Syria or out of their control once there is some sort of guarantee from the Americans that there won't be an attack. Because I wouldn't imagine that... what are your thoughts on that, Martin? How that might work?
Well, I think what's happened now is that Assad has also put his conditions on, which are that the reason why Syria has got chemical weapons is because Israel has got nuclear weapons. So if Israel was to try and nuke Damascus, Damascus can say, yes, but we're going to drop a chemical weapon on Tel Aviv, so don't even think about it. So that's why they got them in the first place. Perfectly logical. And of course, the ultimate solution is to have all of these weapons removed from the Middle East, which has been the position of the Iranian government from the very beginning. Not that we hear anything.
I mean, is there any possibility of the Israelis actually putting their nuclear weapons away from use?
No, there's none at all. So you can see from the Syrians' point of view, well, why should we give up our chemical weapons then? But I think Assad is prepared to give up his chemical weapons, not least because his conventional weaponry is pretty robust and his army is winning on the ground. And if it is proven, it has been proved that the rebels have been using chemical weapons. There's no doubt about it. And I think that the ordinary people in America and in Britain need to recognise this. And in actual fact, we are already, when we say should we get involved in Syria, it seems we already are. That SAS chap who was put on trial the other day for having a weapon, an unregistered weapon and so on, it came out during the trial that the last place he had been is inside Syria. Now, what do you think he was doing inside Syria? I imagine he was training rebels to kill, bomb, maim, destroy. And the Syrians would be a bit foolish in the extreme, but well within their rights, if SAS people are involved in killing their soldiers, to come to Britain and kill some of our soldiers. That's what I'd do if
what
I was
about,
them.
What about the attack this week on several Syrian villages? Some of them, one of them is one of, apparently one of the places that the only place where biblical Aramaic is still spoken. This has been was taken over by the rebels, and now the government has taken back control of it with the death of something like 20 or 30 civilians.
Well, the Christian minority in Syria supports Assad. There was actually an internal document leaked, a NATO internal assessment. It was their internal assessment of what was going on the ground inside Syria, and it got leaked. And it estimated that Assad had the support of around 70% of the population. The rebels had around 10% support, and the rest were undecided. Now, this is the so-called mandate for the Free Syrian Army and all the rest of it. And ultimately, basically, it looks as if the Western powers, led by Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they are Western powers, whether people like it or not, even though 19 of the hijackers on 9/11 supposedly came from Saudi Arabia, although many of them are subsequently shown to be alive and therefore couldn't carry out the hijacking. Why is it that Saudi Arabia, the fount of extremist Muslim terrorism in the world, nobody disputes that, why has nothing happened to them? We just sell them loads of weaponry. Meanwhile, Assad, who was actually being used by the CIA during the rendition programme, they were sending him people to torture because he was part of the team. He's got to be bombed, but Saudi Arabia, where all the supposed hijackers came from on 9/11, they get sold weapons. Why would that be? Oh, well, how many elections have they had in Saudi Arabia? They did, in fact, have a referendum inside Syria, even though there was a civil war going on, which 60% plus participated, but the West just said, huff, puff, huff, puff. When was the last referendum in Saudi Arabia or any kind of democratic election? Oh, right, they haven't had one ever. And they're kind of exporting terrorism. Most of the Sunni terrorists inside Iraq that are planting bombs in Shia mosques, they're being armed and trained by the Saudi military. Who arms and trains the Saudi military? Oh, they all go to Sandhurst, don't they? Of course, all those Saudi lieutenants and captains. Who trains them? We do. We do.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of Assad on the BBC, but we will hear from him in a minute. That was on Charlie Rose on CBS. But first of all, let's go back to question time in the House of Commons last week, where Sir Peter Tapsell, who's the father of the House, asked a question about Syria.
Sir Peter Tapsell!
As the Syrian tragedy has unfolded, I've always had the Armageddon question in the back of my mind, which I shall now, in an understated form, if I may, put to the Prime Minister. If the Americans illegally bombard the Assad forces and Assad legally invites the Russians in to degrade the rebels, what will NATO do?
Prime Minister.
Well, the first point I'd make to the right honourable gentleman is that we would never support illegal action. And we just debated and discussed this at some length last week. And it isn't the case that the only way action can be legal is a UN resolution. So we'd only support action that was legal. We'd only support action that was proportionate. As I've said, Britain wouldn't be taking part in any of this action. But in a way, you have to put the Armageddon question round the other way, which is that if no action is taken following President Obama's red line, and if no action is taken following this appalling use of chemical weapons, you have to ask yourself, what sort of Armageddon are the Syrian people going to be facing?
Well, I think Sir Peter Tapsell put his finger right on it there. And of course, if it does transpire that it was the rebels who've used chemical weapons, they've certainly used it before Damascus. And in actual fact, there are suggestions that the children that were shown in the videos were actually the children of regime loyalists from Latakia, their parents were murdered. They were then given poisoned, not with sarin, but with chlorine. And then they were used as a mechanism to cause an airstrike. Now, if it turns out that our own side have been using unconventional chemical weapons, I put this to David Cameron, what should we do then? And if it turns out that MI6 were involved in it and that you knew about it, Prime Minister, then it's not Assad who's going to The Hague, it's you, isn't it?
So are you suggesting then that possibly some of the children involved in those films were actually captured from the regime side, the parents killed and the children just used in the films and poisoned by some other method?
That's correct.
And whereabouts have you got that
information? That was on Voltaire Network, which is a French website. Now, these things have not been verified, but it certainly has been verified that there's been a leaked US military document yesterday which clearly said that the rebels did have and were using chemical weapons. No doubt about that at all. Okay, Assad would be a fool to use chemical weapons. Just a logical thing. He's called in chemical weapons inspectors to look into the rebels' use of chemical weapons. On the day they arrive, the rebels, he supposedly uses chemical weapons on a random neighbourhood, killing loads of children, but no women and no adults. It's very odd. It just stinks, frankly, doesn't it? Like a chemical weapon.
Well, the CBS News Network in the United States aired an interview with Bashar al-Assad, and here's a little extract from it now.
The biggest challenge is how can we keep our society as secular as it is today?
As secular?
Secular, the society, not the government. It is secular. You have diversity, very rich diversity in Syria, we are proud of. But at the end, you're part of this region. You cannot stay isolated from the conflicts surrounding you. If you have sectarian Lebanon on our west and sectarian Iraq on our east, and you don't have the peace process solved on our southern border, and you have the terrorists dominating the region and let's say growing with leaps and bounds, you'll be affected someday. You'll pay the price. So it's not about being passive and say, I'm going to protect myself. How can you be active and expand what you have to the other? So the challenge is the extremism in this region. They always use religions to assume the mantle of religions or Islam or whatever in order to have followers. They only assume it. I don't think they are convinced about what they are doing. Some of them, they are ignorant, they believe, they think they are helping the religions this way. But at the end, it's not about those, it's about the others. How can they influence? Because, I mean, you always have extremists in everything, in politics, in religions, in Christianity, in Islam, in Judaism. In every religion, you will have extremism. But it's about how much can they influence the society. As long as you have open-minded people, you don't worry about those. They're going to be isolated. That's why I said it's not about who's like you and who's not. This first, it's about the cause. They have code, they have support, and this is first. Second, they're not extremists. But if you mean Hamas,
Hezbollah is not extremist.
No, it's not.
What is it?
They support peace. If you want peace, they support peace. They believe in Islam as to be the government in their country. This is their freedom they are free to think whatever they want. But they never try to implement it by force. This is where you cannot label them as extremists. The extremist wants to force you to go in a certain way. And sometimes they threaten you and sometimes they kill you. This is extremism, not to have your idea. Your idea, of course, we're going to have different ideas, different currents, political currents and religious currents. That's normal. And this is the diversity that we have. But they are not extremists because they never try to implement by force their doctrine.
That's President Bashar al-Assad of Syria there talking to Charlie Rose on CBS, Martin. I mean, his main point really seems to be about trying to keep his country secular, and he's having a battle to do it.
Yeah, well, those who are cynical would say that he's just saying that in actual fact he's a dictator and all the rest of it. But the fact is that Bashar al-Assad as the Middle East is a pretty tough neighbourhood, and in Saudi Arabia you have 30,000 political prisoners. And as I said earlier, all 19 hijackers on 9/11 were supposedly from Saudi Arabia. In actual fact, various of these so-called hijackers turned up alive, according to the BBC and the Daily Telegraph at the time. So in actual fact, 9/11 is fairly clearly is a security service Gladio-style false flag, which is pretty much what looks like this this chemical weapons attack.
But we keep hearing this term false flag. Just remind us, what does it actually mean?
Originally comes from naval warfare in the 18th century, because of course people didn't, you know, they had telescopes and naked eyes. They couldn't really tell what was happening, especially in fog or rain or whatever. So you creep up to your enemies with a flag. Oh, they're flying a British flag. That's okay. They're one of ours. And then of course when you get close, you suddenly, it turns out that they're French.
And
whatever.
How does that translate itself into what's happened in Syria and 9/11?
You do, the Gladio structures in Western Europe during the 1970s and 1980s were carrying out all kinds of terrorist attacks, which were blamed on left-wing extremists, right-wing extremists, and so on. But of course the real structure was what they called in Italy the strategia di tensione, freak everybody out. There's all these ordinary people being blown up by terrorists, isn't it? We've got to have more police, more army, more control. And it turns out of course it's the police and the army who are carrying out the attacks. The Egonican network in Turkey worked in a similar kind of way inside the Turkish
state. But it's even sometimes intelligence services or you know, to a certain extent a private security carrying out these attacks on police, and even sometimes on the armed forces.
Oh yes. If you're not in the loop, you can be a target. So in Italy, they killed two carabinieri in a car, and said, "Oh, the terrorists are killing carabinieri," but it was in fact the government killing.
So in this world, the honest cops have got the most to fear.
Indeed, but they're the only thing between us and chaos. Fernandino Imposimato, I think it is, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book which came out in December 2012 called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, in which he details all of the attacks that took place in Italy in the 70s and the 80s carried out by the intelligence services but blamed on others. And of course this is a standard procedure of NATO. Turkey, Egonican, NATO. NATO, this is what they do.
Okay, staying in the region and also staying with Westminster and Prime Minister's questions this week, Bob Russell brought up a question about Israel, saying that they're ethnically cleansing a lot of Arab Bedouin.
Sir Bob Russell, successive governments have condemned ethnic cleansing. Will the Prime Minister today condemn Israel for its ethnic cleansing of 40,000 Bedouin?
Well, this government has a very clear policy on the issue of Israel and on the issue of settlements. We respect and welcome Israel's right to exist, and we defend that. But on settlements, we think that the Israeli approach is wrong, and we condemn the settlement activity. And we've been consistent in saying that both privately and publicly.
Well, he's not condemning ethnic cleansing of Bedouin, but he is condemning settlements, Martin.
Well, that has been the British position for 50 years. But of course, in actual fact, we are working quite closely with the Israelis. If there is a war with Syria, it's quite likely that the Israelis will be cooperating with our own armed forces. Maybe it's about time to do to Israel what we did to Serbia in the 1990s. If they won't withdraw behind the Green Line, won't withdraw from Kosovo, then we bomb them, including their TV stations, which tell lies, like we did with the Syrians. Kill their weather girls.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now on to the Omar bombing. Families are to fight on as the government this week rules out a public inquiry. Just give us a bit of background of this, Martin. Apparently an attack carried out by, supposedly anyway, by the real IRA that killed 29 people.
Yes, I don't think anybody disputes that, including the real IRA.
So just tell us a bit about the background to the... Why is there not going to be a public inquiry? Why should there be a public inquiry?
Well, I think the relatives believe that the real IRA carried it out, and in fact the real IRA basically said they carried it out.
But so this is just to sort of place this. It's August 15th, 1998.
Yeah, but the what is clear is that the security services, RUC Special Branch in particular, had infiltrators inside the real IRA, and that in actual fact they had full knowledge of the whole operation, largely because of Kevin Fulton, not his real name, who was basically stole the car for the operation, you know, to put the bomb in. And when he'd stolen the car, he told his handlers, "This is the car they're going to use," and he gave them the the number and all the rest of it, you know, the registration number. So they should, in fact, have interdicted the car and stopped the bombing. That's what the relatives are upset about, because they believe that there's been a cover-up by the security services.
And what are your thoughts? Because, I mean, I can remember listening to the live coverage of that attack on the day on the radio. One of the radio commentators said that various members of the public had been coming to him and saying that the police had actually been directing them towards the bomb. Now, this is particularly worrying because there was a warning given and the police should have known to direct members of the public away from the car, but actually members of the public were being directed towards
the car. Well, this is the sort of thing that inquiry would look into. Was that a genuine mistake by the officers on the ground who just didn't know where the bomb was and were doing what they're doing their best in the circumstances, or did somebody know which car was the bomb and perhaps either the police knew or perhaps they hadn't been told by somebody else? I think more likely is that the police had not been told which car was the bomb, and this often happens in anti-terrorist work because you want to protect the informer concerned. If you actually interdict every bomb, then they're going to work out who's telling tales out of school and remove them from the picture, and therefore you lose your information. But also there is a suspicion that the real IRA and the Securocrats in Northern Ireland had both an interest in smashing the peace process, and a good bomb that killed a load of people would actually, you know, undermine the position of the peacemakers on both sides. If that was the goal of the real IRA, it was the real IRA's goal, and if they were being helped in that by people in the security establishment, it didn't work. It didn't work at all, because in actual fact, the bomb brought the whole community together to condemn the attack and actually push the peace process further forward. And I'd say to the relatives, I understand your suffering and your pain, and I actually support your call for an inquiry. But in actual fact, they didn't die in vain, because in actual fact, the peace process was cemented by the Omar bomb, and the fools that carried it out shot themselves in the foot.
Northern Ireland Secretary Teresa Villiers says she believes a continuing inquiry by the Police Ombudsman for Northern Ireland was the best way to address any outstanding issues. I mean, it seems that there is a real reluctance to carry out full public inquiries into so many events. I mean, there's all sorts, Marty, and this is just one of them. I mean, why is that? Are they something to hide?
Well, I mean, Sinn Féin have been pushing for a full Truth and Reconciliation Commission investigation of everything that happened, because this is one atrocity. I mean, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs in 1972, which killed more people than Omar between them, there are all sorts of questions about that, because the Glenane gang that carried it out were possibly helped by British intelligence. That's what the Garda Síochána think in the Republic. So there's lots and lots of dirty washing to be looked at here, and perhaps what we need to do, which is what Sinn Féin have been pushing for, is let's not point fingers, let's not try and punish individuals, let's just get to the bottom of who really did what, and then we can all move on. Because, of course, the state, the force research unit run by the British Army, was basically directing the Loyalist terror campaign. So of all the people the Loyalists killed, they were cooperating with the British Army. People in the Republican side know that very well. Most ordinary British people don't realise that there's two sides in a war, it's not just a one-sided thing. And the point of going back over it is not in order to point fingers and to make blame. The point is so we can all understand what happened and make sure it doesn't happen again, and we all move into a better future for everybody in both islands.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, on the subject of driving, hackers have revealed nasty new car attacks. This is from Forbes magazine a couple of weeks ago. Stomping on the brakes of a £3,500 Ford Escape that refuses to stop or even slow down produces a unique feeling of anxiety. In this case, it also produces a deep groaning sound like an angry water buffalo bellowing somewhere under the SUV's chassis. The more I pound the pedal, the louder the groan gets, along with a delighted cackling of two hackers sitting behind me in the back seat. Martin, this is all about hacking into some of these modern cars, which have got computer control systems which actually intervene between you pressing the brake pedal and the brakes actually going on, and also, of course, between you pressing the accelerator and the accelerator actually going on. The technology seems to be racing away so far. This in this particular case, Forbes have got a couple of hackers sitting in the back of the car, and as the guy's trying to drive along, thankfully at sort of just 5 miles an hour or so, they're messing with him. They're doing things like making it look like his speed is much higher than it is, actually even making his driving steering wheel jerk from side to side. And when he puts his foot on the brake, it actually doesn't stop at all. It starts going faster.
Yes, very worrying technology. It may be something to do with the death of Michael Hastings in California, who was a journalist investigating the CIA and the FBI, who drove like a grandmother, apparently, but he was last seen driving his car at 75 miles an hour.
In a brand new black Mercedes.
Yeah, in a brand new black Mercedes, 75 miles an hour, it crashed into a tree, there was an explosion, the engine block ended up far away from the actual chassis of the car, and there's lots of suspicion in the US, even in the mainstream, that this guy was assassinated, probably by CIA or FBI, because that's who he was investigating. And of course, if you've got one of these cars, which they can hack into the computers, then that's how it would happen. And of course, that would explain, of course, what happened with the aeroplanes on 9/11, because the technology for flying aeroplanes from the ground has existed. It's called Global Hawk. It's existed since the 1970s. I believe the US military flew a plane from the US to Australia in 1971 without anybody on board.
So what was the logic? Okay, let's look at the aircraft thing to begin with. What's the logic behind that? Why would someone want to actually be able to fly an aircraft from the ground?
Because the idea that it was sold to the people funding this as a means to deal with hijackers. So hijackers have hijacked an aircraft and they say, you know, fly me to a free country or whatever it is, you know. And they say, oh, sorry, we can't. We're being flown from the ground and they're flying us home. And therefore, that was the justification for the technology. But of course, it does mean that you can fly the aircraft from the ground. And I would suggest that's a much more straightforward explanation of why four aircraft managed to dodge the whole of the US air defence for an hour and a half and then crashed with precision exactitude into buildings in Washington and New York. Far more likely that it was a Global Hawk technology flying from the ground, therefore an inside job, than amateur light aircraft.
Well, they couldn't even fly light aircraft.
No, apparently their instructors thought them incompetent to fly light aircraft. So, yeah. And of course, the other thing is, it was suggested that that all they needed to do was program the computers on board the planes to fly them directly to the targets. But of course, the planes didn't fly directly to the targets. They actually took rather circuitous routes to the targets. And of course, you can't fly from by sight from above the cloud level. You just can't do it. So, how on earth did the hijackers fly the planes?
Well, maybe they were using the compass or something, a navigation system on the aircraft.
Far more likely that they were all four planes were flown from the ground, I think. Far more likely with this kind of technology, which is now used in cars.
Coming down to earth a bit with this, I mean, this has hit the headlines to a certain extent with sudden unintended acceleration, which is what it's called, and several people have died now with cars that have just started accelerating for no apparent reason. Just a tip to listeners, if anything like that ever does happen to you, God forbid, the most important thing to do immediately is to turn off the engine, because unless you do that, actually to switch the car off, unless you do that, I mean, you could completely lose control of the car. Hopefully then it will allow you, if you've still got a little bit of power in the engine and your brakes, to actually manually slow the car down and stop safely. I mean, we've had several makes of cars, Martin, being a subject to this. First of all, it was modern Audi cars. Then it was a Toyota. The Toyota Prius apparently was very vulnerable to this. And then also Mercedes have made a big thing of having driverless cars so that their cars can be controlled by computers without actually having anybody sitting in them too. A bit like you were talking about the aircraft flying in the 1970s over to Australia. But this is surely a really, really interesting example of just how the technology is running way, way ahead of what any of the people who are actually supposedly in control of those cars can understand. I mean, we have a friend, Adrian, don't we? He was driving a hire truck down the motorway, and suddenly it starts saying to him, no, you cannot drive any faster than, I think it was 30 miles an hour. So he had to go into the slow lane, drive very, very slowly on the motorway. He was getting a little message from the car. These electronic components on these cars, it seems, are just getting too clever for their own good.
Well, yes, and I think all technology, the best technology is the simplest technology. So, for example, I'm sure the Syrian rebels will agree with me. The AK-47 rifle is far superior to more sophisticated weapons because it's idiot-proof. whereas the more sophisticated weaponry, for example, the chemical weaponry which they were using in Damascus, what we're hearing, the whisper is that they actually couldn't handle it properly, and that's why they ended up killing themselves. That's one of the theories that's circulating. Technology, the simpler it is, the easier it is to deal with if it goes wrong. The more complex it is, look at the complexity of modern financial markets. Far more complex than in previous eras, but of course far more prone to potentially catastrophic failure.
Anyone that's worried about the possibility of their car electronic system on their car being hacked, I would thoroughly recommend you look up a YouTube film called Unintended Acceleration, The Truth. Very grandly titled, by a US freelance, I suppose you'd call him, car mechanic, Scotty Kilmer, who explains how you could find out if your accelerator pedal is actually really connected to your engine or whether it's via some sort of hackable computer. So that's Scotty Kilmer, K-I-L-M-E-R, if you want to find out more about that.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, Martin, TEPCO has admitted leakage of 300 tonnes of water with monstrous radiation levels over at Fukushima. Also, of course, the South Koreans have now banned fish imports from around the Sea of Japan. So this is not going away, is it, this particular nuclear disaster? We thought Chernobyl was going to be one of the worst in history. This one now seems to be overtaking them at a rate of knots. They've got hundreds and hundreds of tons of water which they're having to store. Some of it's leaking into the groundwater, some of it getting into the sea.
Yes, and another interesting aspect of this is it has been suggested, and I'm not saying it's true, but it has been suggested that the Stuxnet virus had something to do with the lack of control at Fukushima. Stuxnet virus, if I can remind you, the US and the Israelis basically admitted that they wrote this virus, which is designed to mess up nuclear power stations. And they designed it in order to mess up the Bushehr nuclear power station, which the Iranians are constructing. And therefore, I think it was in the Washington Post or the New York Times, they reported that it was reported to Obama, do you want the good news or the bad news, Mr. President? Tell me the good news. The good news is that the Stuxnet virus has trashed the Bushehr Iranian nuclear power station, and all their computers are basically messed up. I said, good, good. What's the bad news? The bad news is one of their employees put a memory stick into his computer and took the virus home, put it into his own personal computer, and now the Stuxnet virus is roaming the planet, potentially finding other nuclear targets. So there is a possibility, and I think an inquiry needs to be had into this, that the Stuxnet virus was partly responsible for the breakdown of control at Fukushima. But I would just put this to people who are listening. How responsible is it for US and Israeli tax dollars to be spent on writing malware that messes up nuclear power stations? How responsible is that?
Well, the latest today is that Fukushima is not under control. A TEPCO official refutes the Prime Minister's assurances. A senior TEPCO official has contradicted Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Japan by saying radioactive water leakage at the crippled Fukushima plant is not, repeat, not under control. The official, Yasuhiko Yamashita, was asked his opinion of comments by Abe regarding the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, the International Olympic Committee in Buenos Aires last Saturday. I think the current situation is that it is not under control, Yamashita said at the hearing in Koriyama City. And in reaction to Yamashita's comments, Democratic Party of Japan Secretary General Akishiro Onata, gosh, it's all very awkward names here, told reporters that the Prime Minister should fully explain what led him to his pronouncement last week. And this water is leaking out, Martin, quite clearly. Tritium levels spiking 15-fold just in the last 3 days. The French are doing cartoons about these Olympics. The 2020 Olympics are going to be radioactive, apparently.
Well, everybody's taken their eye off this ball, haven't they? Because we've all been stressing about the idea that Britain and others might lob cruise missiles onto chemical weapons factories inside Syria. Can you imagine how sensible that would be, actually, blowing up a chemical weapons factory? Like, do you remember when Clinton blew up the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, claiming it was a chemical weapons factory, in order to distract attention from his affair with Monica Lewinsky, and then they had to admit later on it was a pharmaceutical factory? What if it had been a chemical weapons factory? How sensible is it to hit it with a cruise missile?
Well, not very sensible at all, Martin. Anyway, what do you think is going to happen with this? Any ideas, Martin? I mean, it doesn't seem that they're in control of Fukushima. And also, I mean, for me, the most worrying thing is fish exports right around the world. How do we know if there's now radiation in fish? The South Koreans have certainly decided they're not having any fish from around the Japanese seas at all.
Well, the danger is that the whole Pacific Ocean could be contaminated for generations. And that's a serious threat to human existence. The use or non-use of chemical weapons in a minor spat in Syria is not really in the same league, is it?
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, it's good old Friday the 13th, of course, today, the origins of which most people look at it believe are to do with the Knights Templar being arrested on Friday the 13th of October 1307. Hundreds of Templars were arrested in France by Philip the Fourth of France, who was known as Philip the Fair. He ordered the arrest under treason charges of the Order of the Knights Templar. Philip saw both groups as a state within a state. There were others too that were arrested. Martin, these Knights Templar, they were the first ever multinational corporation. They were also the bankers of their day. They'd been going on crusades for hundreds of years.
A hundred years or so.
Yeah. And those crusades apparently were starting to, the popularity was starting to wear thin. So there's one side that says that this was just pure opportunism. Philip the Fair wanted to get his hands on the Templar loot. But there's also the other side that they were actually not Christians, a Christian order at all. They were some kind of weird satanic order, and that's why he had them arrested. What's your thoughts on the Knights Templar and if they're in any way interesting still today? Because, of course, Bristol was a Templar port.
Well, I mean, the Templars were a very interesting historical organisation, and of course Philip the Fair certainly did believe that they had a satanic, that they were satanic, etc., etc. That was his. That's why he claimed that he decided to get rid of them.
Now, what they say, of course, is that the confessions were extracted under torture,
yeah.
But there were several knights that weren't tortured that voluntarily gave confessions as well. So that does muddy the waters.
Yeah, but the voluntary confessions, people could probably say, well, you know, we'll actually see you all right if you give us a confession. Because that's what we want. I mean, don't forget, we're not talking about a magistrate's court in Bristol in 2013. Basically, you know, medieval courts were, you know, by modern standards, basically show trials. So,
talking about the possibility of, it already does happen, doesn't it, for quite a lot of people, anonymity in British courts, and that doesn't mean that justice is not being done if people are anonymous.
I think what's shocking is the kind of trial that the Templars got in the 12th century there is exactly the same kind of trial that is being meted out to people in Guantanamo, i.e., no proper trial. And of course, Guantanamo is the tip of the iceberg. There are actually probably hundreds of black prison sites around the world now where people are being held without any kind of legal basis whatsoever, in complete defiance of habeas corpus, which was incorporated into British law in 1215. But obviously, we're so modern now, we don't have to bother with habeas corpus. The state is allowed to do whatever it likes to people, and it does.
Well, the arrest of the Templars was Friday 13th of October 1307, but it wasn't until March 1314 that the last Grand Master of the Temple, Jack de Molay, was burnt at the stake outside Notre Dame Cathedral. Now, what about this? The theory, Martin, that some people say that the French Revolution was a kind of revenge for what had happened to the Templars hundreds of years afterwards. That was in the 1790s. That is an outlandish theory, but it was put forward by the occult writer Dennis Wheatley several times, and you know, he was fleshing it out with quite a lot of evidence, saying that there was a connection between the supporters of de Molay through the Grand Orient lodges in France right the way up to the time of the French Revolution, and they were cooperating with German Freemasons, the so-called Bavarian Illuminati, in order to try and precipitate the French Revolution in the 1700s. Is it all poppycock?
Well, I mean, I'm aware of these theories, and I'm also aware that, you know, I read an awful lot of academic history books about the French Revolution, about the Templars, and I've read a lot of medieval history. And I have to tell you that the peer-reviewed mainstream historical record does not tend to, Dennis Wheatley is a novelist, let's face it. And also...
Well, he's a historical novelist.
Yes, I'm also, frankly, I am... what's the word? I'm sceptical about the idea of anything going on for generations. We've all got a sort of a very limited lifespan. And I might, for example, want to set up a revolution in 20 years' time and work towards it. You know, in actual fact, I do. But I'm never going to see it. And in actual fact, my control over it, if it does happen, will be zero if it happens after I'm dead. And that's the real world.
Well, that's supposedly the power of these secret societies, isn't it? That they lie in wait for centuries. Anyway, let's get a move on now to look at this, letter from Albert Pike to Giuseppe Mazzini. First of all, something to say a little bit about Pike himself. This is a letter which went out in the mid-1800s, supposedly talking about three world wars that were going to be created. Albert Pike was a brigadier general in the US Civil War Confederate Army. He was a lawyer and a very strong advocate of slavery, appointed as a Confederate envoy to the Native Americans and doing deals with them. He was faced with charges that his troops had scalped soldiers in the field at the Battle of Pea Ridge, and he was a Freemason. In fact, he was one of the top ones in America. He was sovereign Grand Commander for the Scottish Rite's Southern Jurisdiction. He's also been named as influential in the early Ku Klux Klan, being named in 1905 as the chief judicial officer of the Klan by one of the Klan's sympathetic historians, Walter Fleming. So there's Albert Pike for you. The letter he wrote was to Giuseppe Mazzini, who's an Italian politician, journalist and activist for the unification of Italy. Mazzini was an early advocate of a United States of Europe about a century before the European Union began to take shape. While the book 10,000 Famous Freemasons by William Denslow lists Mazzini as a Mason, past Grand Master of Orient of Italy, others say he wasn't a Freemason. Anyway, let's have a listen now to some commentary about this letter, which is supposed to talk about the idea of having three world wars, really to totally disrupt humanity and to impose a kind of international government.
Now, Albert Pike wrote a letter to Mazzini, and that was dated August 15, 1871, in which he propagated that there should be a world order, a one order where all nations are under the control of one central organization. And in order to achieve this, they planned, and there are numerous quotes for this, so I've put a number on the screen, because some will say, I don't trust this, I don't trust that, I don't trust the other. Here are references down there. There are references up there. There will be references in other slides, so it comes from different sources. He said, and this was, by the way, on display in the British Museum and could be seen there until it was taken away. The First World War, to overthrow the power of the Tsars in Russia, protector of orthodoxy, and bring about an atheistic communistic state. Did that happen? Yes. Now, that was written long before this event. Long before this event. This was written in 1871. This war broke out in 1914. The Second World War. That's also written long before the event. To originate between Great Britain and Germany, to strengthen communism as antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture, and bring about a Zionist state in Israel. Did it achieve this objective? Yes. In fact, after this war, Israel, in its present form, was reinstated under the protection of Britain. And then, interestingly enough, a Third World War, a Middle Eastern war involving Judaism and Islam and spreading internationally. That's fascinating. Is that on the cards, or what do you think? Certainly sounds like we are on track. Well, here's another quote. Mazzini with Pike developed a plan for three world wars, so that eventually every nation would be willing to surrender its national sovereignty to a world government. The first war was to end the Tsarist regime in Russia, the second to allow the Soviet Union to control Europe, the third world war was to be in the Middle East between Muslim and Jews and would result in Armageddon.
Well, that's Stanley Monteith there talking at something called The Prophecy Club. He's the author of Brotherhood of Darkness. Martin, is it totally fantastical? Could there be any truth to it? And does it sometimes the academics miss stuff? I mean, I know when I was looking into the Bilderbergers, I was amazed that academia has completely passed it by.
Well, I think that everybody who wants to make an opinion about this is entitled to their opinion, but they've got to expect to be interrogated about that opinion. The real causes of things like the French and Russian revolutions I mean, yes, there were specific political causes and political splits in the Russian Social Democratic Party, for example, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, all the rest of it. There's a history of all of that. But don't forget, you've also got an oppressed population who are fed up with being pushed around. And who can plan that? That's just the way it is. I mean, there was in the French Revolution, quite likely, probably broke out when it did, because they'd had several years of bad harvests and there wasn't enough bread. How did anybody plan the bad harvests? Did they plan that? Or was that just sort of weather?
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
And now to pick up a conversation we started last week, which was really about the current state of the Nuremberg rally site in Nuremberg, the great stadium there. Martin, apparently it's falling to bits. The German government have decided that they would like to spend £60 million, that I think that is, was it €70 million, to bring it all up to scratch, to turn it into a tourist attraction.
Well, I think I would probably argue that it is of historical interest and it's probably a usable piece of kit, so it probably does make sense to rebuild it. I think what's more problematic is places like Auschwitz and Majdanek, which were concentration camps, which were originally designed to be impermanent. If you go to either Auschwitz or Majdanek, I've been to both of them, you'll see that the concrete gas chambers are still fairly intact. But of course, all of the wooden huts and barbed wire fences are, after all these years, falling to bits. Now, what do you do with that? Do you let them fall to bits? Or do you, you know, basically rebuild them so that they're there for people to see? And I think this is actually a bit of a dilemma for the Polish authorities, what to do with sites like that.
OK, well, let's now go back to 1992 and have a listen to the BBC broadcaster Jonathan Meads, who did quite a fascinating exploration of the Nazi culture as well as their architecture in a programme called Jerry Building.
Nazism did not die in the ruins of Berlin in 1945, nor on the gallows at Nuremberg in 1946. It merely buried its uniform, slipped into mufti and sauntered into the post-war world. Himmler was a patron of exercises in racial pseudo-history and cosmic pseudo-science. In this Gasthof, he entertained the scholars of the New Order, who reported to him in his neo-feudal fiefdom. This place renders agrarian kitsch sinister and corn dollies a prop of genocide. These are some of the projects undertaken by the ersatz scientists of the Deutsche Zahnenerbe, the SS's ancestral research department. They show how far into reason and credulous infantilism Germany had slipped. They sought to prove that Jesus Christ was an Aryan. This was an idea first posited by Richard Wagner, the patron composer of anti-Semitism. An archaeological dig in Tibet was intended to uncover the fossilized remains of a race of giants from whom Aryans were supposedly descended. A scientist who went on to work at NASA under Wernher von Braun complained that he'd lost 2 years of his career working with radar to demonstrate that the Earth is the inner core of another hollow planet. Himmler himself believed in reincarnation for Aryans only, in numerology, astrology, folk remedies, and homeopathic pest control. At the heart of Nazism, there were hippies in uniform. Even then, they were referred to as armed bohemians. The German dead, it seems, are always with us. And Nazism was nothing if not a death cult. It glorified death, from which it promised return. It was fascinated by death. Its sanctioned murderers wore skulls. Its high priests killed millions, then killed themselves. Death was truly its speciality, and its iconography is persistently morbid. Almost half a century after the end of Nazism, the official end, there is no unanimity about how to deal with the sites that were most holy to it. Whilst the party grounds at Nuremberg rot gracelessly, Hitler's Mountain Erie has become a place of pilgrimage. There can be no question that Speer built big, and he certainly impressed the hundreds of thousands of impressionables who attended the week-long September rallies in a state of impressed delirium. Like some priestly Busby Berkeley, he stage-managed mass mesmerism, mass enchantment, and the central right of the party, in which Hitler brought the blood flag of the Nazi martyrs into contact with all the other flags, in a gesture that has been compared with that of a cattle breeder inserting a bull's penis into a cow's vagina. Speer, though, has many devotees, the Speer carriers, the keepers of the toxic flame. Chief among them is one Leon Krier, a man who genuinely believes that Speer is the greatest architect of the 20th century. This is a piffling opinion and would be of absolutely no moment were it not for the fact that Krier is one of the chief architectural advisors to the Prince of Wales. It's useful to know where those dim populist opinions actually come from.
Well, never repeated, but fantastic. Anyway, 1992 that was. It's not also, Martin, that particular documentary is not on the BBC's Jonathan Meade's collection, which is pretty terrible. But anyway, he talks about the Nazis continuing on. He's also talking there about certain places being used virtually like shrines, maybe Nuremberg too. But it's, I think, fascinating to hear there the sort of philosophy which was being preached at Nuremberg. What about the books?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that Nazism didn't die in 1945, and in fact, fairly senior Nazis were incorporated into the Western power structure. So, for example, Reinhard Gehlen became head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, becomes head of the West German
intelligence. We've recently come across some books, though, haven't we? Yep. Which are really specifically, I mean, fascinating, looking at particularly at the succession network. What happened to the Nazi loot? This is a question people go blank often when you say, what happened to all the looted money from Europe after the Second World War?
Well, according to Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it all got taken to Latin America and then moved back into West Germany. According to
Crichton's book is Op JB, which talks about that too, and Martin Bormann's role. Anyway, time to sign off. Up next, Cyrus the Virus and the Typical Topical Afro-Tropical Show. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Redland, Fee Hance, also, of course, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.